You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
You know, nobody complains that these guys are on too much, which is interesting. Because I think if I was a listener, I would. joining me from McAllen, Texas, is Tim Lynch. Tim, how are you?
Mac, I'm fine, brother. How about you?
I'm excited. Jeff's got a headset, so this ought to be awesome, huh?
And Tim, you got any illegal alien kids living in your garage?
Not me, no.
Not yet. They will be soon, though.
No. I don't have a garage for one. And for two, the illegal aliens, they get policed up and sent out of here in less than 24 hours, bro. They do not play with illegal aliens down here in tropical Texas.
They send them to California.
They send them all over. Not here.
Somebody, his name's Mike. He's a Border Patrol guy. He sent me a message about Kelowna's.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Colonias.
Mm-hmm. And I'm looking for it, but I can't find it. He says, yeah, they're all over. Joining us from Kansas is Will Costantini. Will, how are you?
I'm great.
Man, a few words. I didn't add that. And Jeff Kenny joins us from Southern California, where he just got a haircut. He got a headset, too.
You bet. Good.
It's radio, boys. Somebody got to say something or else it doesn't work so well.
Can you hear me?
We can. Oddly enough, we can hear you. First of all, weather reports. Timmy, in the throes of the cold weather a week ago or just coming out of it, how are things now?
No, it's we're back up to nice, pleasant 70, 80-degree weather. It's just that we have to deal with the dead vegetation. I mean, it just wiped out the all of the yard landscaping around here. All the tropical trees, just brutal.
Really?
So, yeah. Oh, yeah. It's a major mess. We've had to trim our trees down. I'm trying to save my lime tree, but I had to trim all the branches off it just to get down to the green. Yeah. It was weird. You know, once every 100 years or so, you get that kind of cold down here, and it's different.
All right. How about you, Will? Weather report?
70 degrees and sunny yesterday. So it's an 80-degree swing in 1 week. And it's 45 here today.
All right. And that's what would be seasonally normal, someplace between 45 and 80?
Yeah, that's probably right.
And Jeff, how about a weather update? You largely opted out of the cold weather that has consumed Tim and Will. Has that changed?
No, I'm here. And it's like, as you know, it's beautiful. It's like in the high 70s today. And I'm going to, but it's too cold. So I'm going to Tampa, or not Tampa, but Fort Myer, Florida on Friday. See my mom.
Where are you right now?
I'm sitting in San Clemente.
In your apartment?
Yeah.
Oh, all right. Don't get pissed. I was just asking.
I'm not pissed.
What about you? Tell everybody what you're going to Tampa for, though.
Because my mom's 86th birthday. I go and see her at least, you know, once a year on her birthday. And so my uncle Vinny DiPasquale will be there, and his wife Carol. And he's like the last of 11 brothers and sisters. It's my mom and my uncle Vinny are all who's left. So. They'll be there. They're full of piss and vinegar, though, so
it'll
be good. Yeah.
Well, that's good. There you go. Jeff's annual pilgrimage, and hats off to him for doing that. I have a question for you. I asked Will a little bit ago. He can give his answer again, but I find myself purposely staying away from the news because I'm so disgusted by much of it. Whether it be the response to COVID or some of the other things you see around the country. Tim, how are you consuming news these days?
I'm not. I'm just like you. The only time I'll start glancing at news is before we come on air in case there's something important I've missed. But I've And I will read everything Victor Davis Hanson writes. I'll read Powerline most every morning, and that's about as much as I do. I don't particularly care.
Got it. What was that?
I don't know.
All right, neither do I. Jeffrey, how are you?
The FBI.
It's the Chinese piping in. Fuck off, motherfuckers. I'll sign that for you if you want me to. Jeffrey, how are you consuming the news?
Well, about like Tim, except I watch Tucker Carlson, and but it's and then you read a couple things here and there, and it's very depressing, and there's not much hope for the home team, it seems like. I mean, this is really disturbing, the shit that's going on. It's infuriating, you know? It's like, I don't know. I wish this happened when I was younger. Let me put it that way.
And Will, what about you? How are you consuming news these days?
I have not watched network news, you know, the three main networks, in more than 10 years, right, to include CNN. I read stuff on the internet, just read different blogs and news aggregators. And I do it before I work out in the morning, so I get your blood pumping a little bit, better than coffee in many days. But I try and limit it because you just got to be careful of your blood pressure.
Well said.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, it is certainly disturbing. And let me ask you this, and I don't want to dwell too much on current events because they're too depressing, but is this something we haven't seen as a country, the ability for essentially a political party to dominate, you know, the news, you know, as they have sympathetic friends in most social media outlets and virtually all big technology? I know I will get this an email or text here pretty quick saying, is it any different, you know, than it always has been? Tim, do you think it's any different?
I do, because you've never had private corporations and businesses telling you what you can and can't say and where you can and can't bank. We've got a lot of rules, of new rules being forced down upon us, not from the government, but from the new robber barons over in Silicon Valley. I think that's new, because I don't think the old robber barons had nearly as much control over society as a whole as our new masters from Silicon Valley do now. I think that's definitely new.
Right. Will, how about you? Is this same old, and we're just more sensitive to it because we're older and have nothing to do? Or is this different?
No, I think it's very different. I mean, you know, think of even in Vietnam time, when the ABC, CBS, NBC tilted in a certain direction, there were still newspapers all around the country that had different political points of view on their opinion pages, which always is going to bleed onto the front page. There were other things, and there was less control, I think, at that time. And the guy, you know, you and I talked about it a little bit earlier, you know, Rush Limbaugh really broke through that sort of major media to reach across the country. He was a different sort of voice starting out in whatever it was, 1989 or so, that wasn't out there, you know, pre-internet days. If you lived in a town that had competing newspapers, even Washington, D.C., had the Post and the Times. New York City had New York Times, had the Daily News, it had the New York Post, which had different editorial views. You could have different sources, but there was nothing across the country. And Limbaugh really sort of broke that open in many ways. But I don't think there's been anything like what we got now.
Jeffrey, did I already ask you or not?
No, I didn't. But it's unprecedented. It's not just our country. It's throughout the world. And this has been a philosophy that's been through the ages, where, you know, people think, you know, if we just ran everything,
right,
the whole world would be a better, more peaceful, more prosperous place. And usually it ends up in mass murder. And I don't see any difference to where we're heading now. And I have to tell you, what's worse now is you have all these people who their anthem is that insipid song by John Lennon from the 70s. You know, imagine there's no countries. That's the thing they're driving towards. And in order to do that, you have to drive down, they have to destroy any kind of loyalty to one's to one's country, to one's nationality, to your way of doing things, in our case, U.S. Constitution and our amendments. That has to be destroyed. And not only that, but family life has to be destroyed. Genders have to be destroyed. Everything that we've always thought was a given, you know, like a dialectic that we could all agree upon, all that now thrown in the hazard. And the purpose of it is to weaken us and then get us all to be one big docile group that, you know, kind of shuffles through life. And that's at best, but people don't go for that. So there will be blood sooner or later. Somewhere, and maybe a lot of places, this will not stand. It will not continue. That people will resist. And it won't be, I don't know what form it'll take or where or when, but it will not go on. Because, first of all, the people who are doing this are demonstrable morons. You know, they're obvious fools. And that's the most infuriating thing. If you had somebody who had their shit together, like Otto von Bismarck, you go, well, you know, this guy's got his shit together, and I don't want to fuck with him because he'll step on me like an ant. However, these people here, I look at some of these people. I look at Angela Merkel. I look at that jerk off in China, you know, and I think to myself, this is bullshit, man. You know, there's no way they can succeed at this, you know. And I think there's going to be resistance. I don't know what form, which field of endeavor it'll happen, whether it's going to be the border, whether it's going to be, some of the big tech stuff as it pushed across, you know, the oceans and stuff, but it's coming, and it's coming quick.
All right. Let's talk about something that's not nearly as aggravating. Let's talk about guns and marksmanship.
You betcha.
Marine Corps changing its qualification program. Will, you want to tell us about it?
Yeah. So, you know, I've read this article, and the idea is that we want to qualify more in line with combat conditions, I think. I'm looking for the money quote in the front of the article here. So people are going to shoot with all their gear on. They're going to shoot, they say, in more realistic scenarios. They've got to hit moving targets, different shooting drills. You know, and it says, say goodbye to the 1900 era's rifle training that generations of Marines are slogged through every two weeks every year. And, you know, I went through this a little bit at Weapons Training Battalion. Right. And our rifle qualification, the known distance course that we grew up with, you know, fundamentally started in like the 1890s. The commandant realized Marines couldn't hit the broadside of a barn. And so he appointed a director of targetry, I think they called him, and said, fix it. And the guy looked around and found the only people that could hit the broadside of a barn or something better was the NRA. And they shot a course at 200, 300, and 500 yards. And we adopted it. And so that's the genesis of the Marine Corps mythology about marksmanship. I got to say, I've got, you know, I'd have questions, if not heartburn, with the new course. One of the quotes in there from the current CEO of the Weapons Training Battalion is that we're going to give time back to commanders.
Right.
So we take two weeks a year now. I guess we're going to go to 1 week or something like that.
Yeah.
But think of anything that you do as a hobby. Collect stamps, fly fish, do pull-ups. Whatever your hobbies might be, you spend a hell of a lot more than 1 week a year at them. And the idea that we're going to have this very intense qualification course, and I'm not against raising standards whatsoever. That being said,
Hold on. Could you just give everybody a little bit of your background relative to this issue?
So, I don't have a lot of talent in life. One of my talents is actually being able to shoot. And I ended up as a CO weapons train battalion in 2008 to 2010. So weapons train battalion at Quantico owns the, I forget the name of the office. I think it's the Marksmanship Program Management unit that writes the Marine Corps order in regards to marksmanship training in the Marine Corps, both entry-level training and annual requalification training. So those people work directly for me. And so I had some intimate involvement in the marksmanship program, where it started and what it was trying to evolve to at that time.
Thank you.
And if you look at our prior qualification course, it's ridiculous. If the object that you were aiming at, i.e. the black part of the target, you could shoot an entire qualification course, never strike the object of your aim, and still qualify as a Marine Corps marksman.
Yeah.
You shoot 50 rounds and you shot 50 fours, that's 200 points, 190 was marksman. So the course was stupid. But it at least put a rifle in everyone's hands once a year. This course looks to me like an advanced training course that may be good for specifically, you know, certain MOSs. But as a service-wide, you know, what I want to get out of it is, one, people be able to safely handle their rifle. And even going to the range once a year doesn't accomplish that. You know, a weapons train battalion in Quantico, our primary duty was to qualify all the second lieutenants in entry-level training. But our secondary duty was for all the people in the National Capital Region. We would have 5,000 people come through there every year and shoot. And it was terrifying to watch people handling their weapons once a year with live ammunition. It was literally terrifying at times to see what people had with them. You know, a couple of interesting things about this course, they're going to shoot it everywhere in the Marine Corps except at entry-level training.
Right.
So the only place in the Marine Corps that you have professional marksmanship instruction, and by professional, I mean people that's what they do, is at recruit depots and a weapons training battalion for second lieutenants. Everywhere else you go, you've got the coaches, who is the guy who shot expert last year and went to a three-week course and does this twice a year. That's not professional marksmanship instruction. So the only professional marksmanship instruction we got is an entry-level training, but we're not going to shoot the new course in entry-level training. And then some of the other standards look pretty stupid to me. You know, we want to be able to hit moving targets. So if you get into it, you've got an 8-second exposure at a target that's moving 4 miles an hour. What is the combat scenario that someone is at a walking pace, that's 4 miles an hour, and you've got an 8-second exposure to them? You know, the reason we put moving targets in was the commandant at some point said, gee, we can't hit moving targets. And a moving target was a guy moving across an alley from one side of the street to the other. So you got about a 2-second exposure at a guy moving 15 miles an hour. Mm-hmm. And the solution to that is not training people to hit moving targets. The solution to that is combined arms, right? You shoot automatic weapons down that alleyway and let people run into them. So you've got a standard that's meaningless. 8-second exposure, 4 miles an hour. That doesn't mean you can hit a moving target. So I applaud our Marine Corps, but I just think there's a whole lot of other things we can do. We're in we're in the third decade of the 21st century. There's all kinds of automation and simulation that we could do for much less investment. and actually train people, because the way to train people in marksmanship is repetition. People that need to be able to hit the target they're shooting at, they need to be able to do that weekly, at least, I would think.
In some way, shape, or form.
Yeah. And if that's your job, should be to make sure that people can safely put their weapon into action, and yeah, we want to be able to hit targets, know how the thing functions. Yeah, but think of the complications nowadays between optics, lasers, night vision goggles. And think of that guy who's the admin clerk working at the receiving in Quantico. I laud the effort. I just don't know that it's going to accomplish what we think it's actually going to accomplish. And then there's just some significant logic gaps. It's a violation of Marine Corps training philosophy of crawl, walk, run. If you're going to do crawl, walk, run in a qualification course, you start with the easiest things and move to the hardest things. This thing starts at 500 yards, moves to 25 yards or 15 yards, and then moves back to 500 yards. And then just a little bit of physics. Optics are in meters. Our ranges are in yards. There's just a lot of things screwed up in marksmanship, and I'm not sure this is the answer. So I could go on, but I'll stop.
Before you end, every Marine rifleman, do we need to...
Poppycock.
Every
Marine rifle bearer.
Every Marine.
They all know how to pick it up and carry it.
Has rifleman training, but not every Marine is a rifleman. A rifleman is something different.
A rifleman is a cog of a fire team, which is part of a squad, which is part of a greater organization. That's what a rifleman truly is.
And that's a professional. And when that rifleman walks down an alley, right, we don't send motor team mechanics to do that, just like we don't send a rifleman to fix an engine.
There you go.
Right.
Yeah.
All right.
We treat being a rifleman as sort of a hobby.
Yeah. No, I agree. Like anybody can do it. And when you see a professional, you know the difference. Jeff, your thoughts on this and also on the phrase every Marine a rifleman. Because I know that, you know, when we went to give out optics, right, everybody had to have one. What do you mean? I mean, we're all riflemen. Well, no, you're really not. But nobody wanted to say that. And we this thing comes up every once in a while. So your thoughts on the marksmanship course and also that ageless saying in the Marine Corps?
Well, yeah, if we're talking Marine Corps wide, then I think it's a mistake to try and get all hyper realistic with every, like the receiving clerk at Henderson Hall. You know, we need to focus resources on people who it's meaningful to their jobs. But I think the idea of having every Marine qualify once a year, you know, is a good one. And Will's, you know, right about the qualification course. But if you could make it so that a Marine was comfortable, if a Marine, you made him every single Marine who goes through Parris Island, San Diego, capable of being trained at any time. So in other words, once a year, this guy is getting his marksmanship training. And really, almost more important than the marksmanship part of it is what Will is talking about, being able to handle his weapon safely, that part of it. And because we have all these different MOSs and jobs now, it was daunting to try and maintain the every Marine a rifle thing just after the Second World War with all the different jobs you needed to have to operate in the modern world. That problem is exacerbated tenfold now. We're talking time here. So I think, the idea of doing what we do, teaching these Marines how to handle them safely, make sure it's done enough so that if they need to be trained, they can be trained to be infantrymen if necessary. We train these guys to be combat advisors, they're all different MOSs. Like, for instance, the guys who got killed at Ganjigal, we trained them and trained them and trained them. Like 2.5 months in Okinawa. I mean, repetitious, you know, the whole CMP thing. And then again,
so,
up in Bridge.
So you'd have like a, you'd have conceptually, you'd have a two-tiered program?
No, we'd have the one thing that every Marine does once a year.
Right. But
then if your MOS demanded, you need to be, you know, intensely trained. That's a whole other, thing. You know, that's training for your job.
Got
like
it.
The guys who are taking down, you know, ships in a VBSS scenario. That's, you know, for those people who are listening, that's where you're taking on a ship that won't pull over at sea. And the Marines, you know, approach the thing with rubber boats and by helo, you know, fast rope and down. That's sort of training that entails marksmanship training that's highly advanced, more so than like your regular infantry guy who's going to hit the beach in an AAV. So, you know, there's that is separate from this. I think what we should strive to do is make every Marine capable of being trained to a high degree. In other words, the guy can handle a weapon safely. The guy is, you know, he has to maintain a certain level of physical fitness. He has to maintain a certain level of health so that if need be, and there's cases where you do need to have that, you know, he can be trained to a much higher level. You can get guys who are Motor T guys, probably some of our best marksmen with Mod Deuces and Mark 19s by 2006, 2007, were those Motor T guys on the roads because, you know, they were doing it. And they had to be able to do it. So you train Marines up to a level, every single one, where he's capable of being trained to a bigger level if necessary. Because most of their jobs are not relevant to that. When I was a CO of a recruiting station, when I was a recruiter, when I was an embassy guy, I didn't need to have that type of training I needed to go to, you know, Iraq as an advisor or to go to Afghanistan, you know, as an advisor or any of that stuff. Then, you know, you had to do things differently based on the task you're going to perform. And so I think that should be the philosophy. The idea that, you know, every Marine's a rifleman. I mean, Will was talking about crew serve weapons. Even when we first started saying that, it wasn't true. I mean, in those days, you know, we're talking World War I time frame. They use those machine guns. The way you kill people with machine guns, unless they're stupid enough to charge into your wire, was plunging fire. The beaten zone is what killed people. And that's an art form in itself. And there's only so many hours in the day. And the more time you spend doing one thing, is less time you're going to be able to spend doing something else. So, you know, judgment, you know, and being judicious dictates that you got to you have to maintain a balance. But the idea of everyone being trained at a certain level so they just don't shoot each other, you know, and stuff like that is, you know, by accident is super necessary.
So when you look at this program, is it too much? Is it how do you look at it?
Well, I don't think you should try to. Do you remember this? There's nothing new under the sun, as I've said before, quoting the Ecclesiastes. Do you remember like in that? The last time I qualified in the rifle range, because I'm so old, I was a first lieutenant. No, I was a second lieutenant. And and at the end of our shooting, we did this horse shit. We put all our gear on, and you did this like assault. I don't know if you remember. I remember at Lejeune. And always there was some lieutenant who screwed up, who was one of the range officers. Like Will says, they weren't really the top of the line guys. You remember we got online and we did like an assault? So, like, you'd have, like, a major and a master sergeant, and we did this kind of, you know, and then you shot with your gas mask. It was a bunch of, it was a great idea, I think, we started doing it. It was when General Gray was commandant, and he wanted, you know, everybody was trying to be as realistic as they could. But I remember at the end of the rifle range, you did this, like, assault, live fire assault down between the 300 and 200-yard line, I think. And then it went away because it just wasn't practical. So I think that thing that Will basically laid out, it's just not practical. You know, it's not practical with the demands of, you know, you should see how hard it is
But they're going to do this things. And you're going to get a week back.
I don't believe that.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
And plus, it won't be good just to teach them to not shoot each other in the ass. That's what snapping in week is, you know. And, you know, I just there's new technology, though, now where there's stuff like Second Marine Division has this thing, the Gunfighter Gym, where you can, it's really hyper realistic stuff.
Right.
And it doesn't, there's no danger involved. You know, I mean, you without going into it and wasting time, it's the type of thing where they stress that you see guys doing kettlebell shit and pull ups and all their gear on. And then they go through this scenario, like walking down an alleyway and these guys pop up and you're shooting air, you know, you're shooting 5.56 air bullets at them. And, but the recoil is the same. The noise is the same. And, but there's no safety concerns. So you can do iteration isn't, after iteration is, after iteration.
Isn't it your weapon too? I mean, isn't it? Yeah. It's yeah, your, it's your so weapon. It's your eye relief and all of that,
you
right?
And I mean, I'm it's learning about yeah, this thing, but I have to tell you, I just don't know how much it costs. You know, it seems to me that anything with that type of thing would be expensive, and Marines would break.
Yeah,
know?
Break it. So it's like, and it'd be like the Hilo Dunker. Yeah, we'll get to you in 3 months. It was a great idea. Yeah. We're glad we have it, but it's broken, and now we have contractors running it, and they only work 2 hours a day.
And General Furness bought that thing with right. Second Marine Division money. Mm-hmm. And everybody, I mean, Dale Alford, all these gunners, they fucking love it. Guys who, you know, who you know how I would take their word for it, you know what I mean? So that's a one part of technology. But I think practically, you got to get it so everybody shoots at least once a year. They're Marines, for God's sake. You know, but and I think the way we're doing it, if you could do that better with technology, fine, you know. But remember, we got an ISMIT. We all thought, oh, they're great. We can go do marksmanship with the ISMIT. It's cheesy, man. The ISMIT's cheesy, you know. It's just it didn't fulfill the expectations. And like again, because I'm the Nightingale, man. Like Will said, man, repetition. That's how you get good at anything. Anything you do, I got to do everything by repetition. You know, I mean, breathing, running, doing pull-ups, you got to fucking do it a lot. The more you do it, the better you get at it, you know? So and there's no place besides shooting that means more than that is more true for sure.
You know, it's a pity you didn't get to qualify with us at the basic school because
I did qualify at the basic school.
Let me tell you, you want to talk about one of the funniest times to ever go to the range is go to the range with about 30 other captains, and you're all watching each other shoot on pre-qual day and qual day talking.
Oh, you mean as a
yeah.
That was, let me tell you, that shit was funny.
You know, I, I'm not that smart. I am pretty smart, but I'm not, I used to trick fuck myself when I was like a non-rate. I shoot great sometimes, but I was concentrating on the front side post, which is black, and the bull, which is black. And I'm like, am I focusing on the bull, in which case you'll shoot a four for sure, or am I concentrating on the front side post? Oh, fuck. And, you know, you're fucking, you're like bearing in on that thing. So I'm going through, I'm shooting at 3.5, and I said to Gunny, I said, hey, look, I got this issue because I trusted him. So he called me an asshole and a dildo and shit, and then he said, look, the Pogues got this shit called whiteout. And when they fuck up typing stuff, this is back before he had computers, they put this fucking whiteout shit on. When it dries, they could type the right letter there. What you do is you blacken your sights, you get a little drop of that whiteout, you put it on the tip of the front sight post. That won't be a problem. Yeah. Holy fuck, man. I was a fool after that, you know, because I had that white dot and my eye was on that white dot, you know, and, you know, it was like, it was amazing. So, even though it was, I mean, all the type of training we did in 3.5 and, you know, and then beyond, when I really ramped up when I became a second lieutenant and beyond, that one piece of advice, you know, he was a practical guy who recognized the problem and said, and I guess he had seen it before because he snapped it right out at me, you know.
So what you're saying is you illegally modified your equipment, therefore nullifying every qualification and promotion that you've had since Lance Corporal.
I'm a phony.
Send me your DD-214. I will correct that son of a bitch. Let me tell you, my greatest moment on a range came in Quantico. On qual day, I had 1 point to drop at the 500-yard line. And Terry Walsh and Dave High and Duffy White, T. Timmy was probably back there, and they're all sitting back there. Paul Kennedy, right, is sitting back there, and they're all chirping with every shot. It's coming, buddy. It's coming. And I dropped one. I dropped 1 point, and I stood up. It was my one of my greatest moments of my life in front of all. They were so disappointed, but it was a good time. It was a shit talking event and whatnot. Timmy, your thoughts? I mean, you're a gun asshole.
Well, I am. And
let me ask you the concept of baseline and beyond, and then the concept of every Marine a rifleman. Is that, I mean, is at this point, does that hurt the institution because we're trying to get people that don't, that need to be brilliant in the basics to a level that, that they probably don't need, or if they need to get there, we would do it in a nuanced way, which is what Jeff's talking about with different teams and whatnot. Address those things, if you wouldn't mind.
I can remember back to Quantico when I was a second lieutenant at the 500-yard line, and I was amazed that I was hitting the dog targets back then. So the fundamentals that were taught us worked. I've been a gun guy, but not a proficient gun guy till I was trained properly. And after reading the article about this new system that the Marine Corps has come up with, I've got news for you. It's not going to last because they're going to fail too many people. Because I know what it takes to train people to hit when they're moving and on moving targets. Like Will, only I was on the civilian side. I spent a few years at a range too. In my case, front sight in Las Vegas. So I've got a pretty good idea of what training, what it takes to get people to certain levels of competency. That program that's in the Marine Times right now, there's no way anybody's going to, they're going to have so many failures, they're going to change it. There's no way they're going to keep it as is because it's a hard little course. Not if you're proficient in carrying a gun all the time, but if you're not, that's an issue. And it's exactly what Will said. It's repetition. I don't think the infantry needs specialized annual training because that when I was in, I mean, both, I guess, one time MUSOC, one time not MUSOC, we could still find enough ammo that our boys shot all the time. I shot at least once a month. I tried to do a hell of a lot more than that. I think the infantry, at least when I was in, certainly had access to enough ammunition to do proper training if you knew what that proper training was. And quite frankly, the proper training that we conducted when I was a lieutenant was pretty goddamn basic because I didn't know that much, you know? So I'm all about this expertise in weapons training, but the Marines have a long history of putting people into the line. You were talking about it with the guy who did the Iwo Jima boards, the Artie guy, you know? What did the artillery guys spend most of the time doing? They were fighting like infantry. I know that they're both combat arms. I've got no issue with every Marine or a rifleman. I know it's not true because handling weapons is a skill that requires repetition and a lot of it and a lot of attention to detail. But I like the way that we put that emphasis on training Marines. I mean, who the hell thought when I joined Marine Corps that 500-yard target, man, with that little front sight post? Every time I hit that damn thing, I was amazed. And I always hit it, you know, because I did what I was told. It was amazing. But I liked it. And I think the new course, it looks cool. It looks sexy. Moving targets and shooting while moving, it's always good. But quite frankly, they can't. They got to – what are they going to do when everybody starts failing? They're going to have a huge failure rate. People don't shoot well moving unless they practice shooting moving. And that takes a lot of practice to get any decent – any kind of good at, which is a shame because – in a firefight, it's been my experience from observation, mind you, that people move. Sometimes they move into inanimate objects, but everybody starts moving very quickly when the round starts snapping. And so it's always a good skill to have.
You know, Mac, there's a target out we got now called the Marathon Target System. It's moving targets. They're like program them, and they move within a certain area. And so first they'll do, like Will was saying, 4 miles an hour across the street, but then they'll do different things as you get better and better. And you will get better and better shooting at a moving target once you do it. But when you
are these the ones on wheels and they communicate with each other when one, you ought to see this shit. Unbelievable. Yeah. They will, if you program them to counterattack, they will find defilade. They will go to ground, and then they will organize their own counterattack. I mean, it's crazy what these things could do, and they're all-terrain little vehicles. And I mean, I saw them. It was like you're watching. You're going, you got to be kidding me, man. Do you remember all the gymnastics we used to do with those pop-up targets?
Oh, yeah.
At IOC? Uh-huh. We'd truck them all over the place. We had to put up the ballistic shields, right? And they'd get knocked down. We'd put them back up and all the rest of that stuff. These now are kind of the same. That was our artificial intelligence, but these have their own artificial intelligence, and they're mobile, and they're hardened. Yeah, it's unbelievable. Right. You could, in an ambush, they're cruising down the road.
But as soon as you become a platoon commander, the first thing you should want to do is have your platoon do live fire. I mean, not the first thing really, but to incorporate your anti-tank weapons and your machine guns, and to do it with mortars firing in support if possible. You want to get that. When we were in Lima Company, when I was a second lieutenant, we tried our best, if we were going to do squad, to integrate that stuff in. Because like Will's saying, combined arms is what kills people. And the only thing I worry about is with gizmos, like both the gunfighter gym, which I like the idea, and the marathon targets, is we lose the bias towards that. You know what I mean? Like IOC became a course where lieutenants were trying to replicate the stuff that they learned or the stuff they did in IOC. They're trying to figure out ways to do the movement of contact through realistic terrain. They're trying to do, realistic night attacks and then later on mech attacks and stuff like that. They're trying to replicate that so that the first time their guys saw it wouldn't be when it's real. So, that bias is something you just can't be. I'm saying, as long as it doesn't stop with, everybody being good with, like grunts being good with that, there's got to be that bias for combined arms at the lowest level, because that leads to combined arms, bias at the higher level too, appreciation for it.
Right. So I want to get a consensus. So if you were king for a day, Will, the system that you would design would emphasize what? And how would you address the supporting arms not likely to close with anybody, right? Versus your job is to close with somebody.
If I'm king for the day and
if you're securing a rocket site, allow them to close with you and then you'll kill them that way.
Just to me, the fundamentals is number one, safely employ. Number two, engage a type of target. So I want people to do that with the systems that they're going to have. Optic, probably NVG, laser, whatever. I think you can do that with some technological help. I would ensure that all the ranges are automated so that there's no more target pulling. There's no more target scoring. That's a huge time sump. Statistically, yeah. If you take a unit to the range now to do training at that range, how much of the time that they're at the range are they actually executing the training in the modern world? Well, right now, if you assume there's six relays, they're executing training 16 2/3% of the time. That's not a good enough payback. If you automate the targets so that no one has to score, no one has to pull, you can push that number, upwards of 90%. And that allows you to get more repetitions the same amount of time. And so no one should be able to walk away qualification without demonstrating their ability to safely put a weapon into action, take it out of action, and have proficiency in the systems that are integrated into that individual weapon. If you can get that, your infantrymen are always going to use that as a basis to move on to more advanced team and other training. All your other MOSs that don't get to do that per se will at least be able to fall back to that every time if that repetition has been drilled properly. Once a year is still not enough to be able to do that,
no.
right? It's a myth. And like I said, I saw it every week at Weapons Training Battalion. This is no ding on those Marines. That wasn't their job. Their job was turning a wrench down at the airfield or manipulating a computer system or standing in front of OCS candidates. So the idea that you're going to come back once a year and prove, you know, expert proficiency is ridiculous.
Okay, so let me ask you.
It's never been true.
Right, okay. So would you have a standard for people not in the operating forces, and then another standard for if you're in the operating forces, and then another standard?
I'd have that one basic. What are the basics that we want to be brilliant in? The basics are safely being able to use the primary system with its integrated components, sight enhancements, night vision goggles, etc. That's what I want to be brilliant in. And when you move further, you go into an infantry unit. Okay, we've got that basic. We're going to go further with that. Because even the operating forces.
How many times did you do that?
What is an F-35 mechanic? He's in the operating forces.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
So I
believe the service culture is good, that everyone's going to know how to use a gun. The problem is it ain't true right now.
Okay. So is your requirement more than once a year?
And here is, it's zero sum. I would attempt to take the current time constraint and get a lot more value out of it than we currently do.
And automation would obviously be a part of that.
Big time.
Right.
Automation is the only way to be able to do it.
Got it. All right. Jeff, would you anything that you would add to that?
I would just add that, like, this thing, this gunfighter gym, and for the people like Dale and Furness and Dave Furness and all the gunners, Gunner Smith, and that the thing that they're saying about it is, it's realistic enough to have value when you actually have to shoot live. And it's the type of thing where, I guess, the next step of it is, there's one in every regimental area where Marines can go after hours. They can drink beer before they go, like have a couple, because there's no danger involved. There's no real.
Wait a minute! Is that an artificial background behind you?
Where?
Behind you.
No, it's a mirror. No, there's an aura. Jeff is holding. He's got an aura around his head.
It is true. I have been obsessed in the heaven already. I'm putting it off just to be with you guys. It's a picture with a glass frame, and it's the light coming off it. Okay.
Okay.
And that was good to try and get me to not say the brilliant comment I was going to say, but I still remember it. And the thing about it is this gunfighter gym concept, it's going to be accessible. It's accessible enough so that people can use it on their own. They can just show up and do it. And I thought this was kind of a genius move on General Jones, the commandant's part. Maybe it wasn't him, but the idea of having the belt system for the McMap made Marines want to get more proficient and get, you know, higher belts for the prestige that went along with it. I mean, it's not really that way now, you know, after 20 some years, but that type of thing was encouraged people to use their spare time to become more, effective Marines. So, you know, there's that part of it. But again, it's just not practical to have guys whose MOS is not, you know, close combat, close with and destroy, to do more than a little bit, the minimum. And so that minimum should be enough to make them trainable. You know, I mean, boot camp kind of fulfills that system, and then SOI, where the idea is, okay, you've had this, we're going to remind you of it, and then we're going to use that as a basis to train you to whatever it is you need to do. Otherwise, it's just, that's the only way it can be practical and then still have us function, you know, the force.
Okay.
You know, everyone doing their job of turning wrenches and banging on computers and stuff like that.
All right, Timmy, your thoughts?
I'd say we keep the known distance training like we do at the entry level. I think we suspend the requirement for non-combat arms
for annual qualification. I think we could look at doing away with that. I personally would be much more interested in seeing the combat arms infantry and specifically spending a lot more time shooting live rounds. And if you remember, I tried to talk Major Allen into trying to get some kind of abbreviated pistol course like that. Remember we went to that damn thing, Jeff, that high risk personnel pistol thing?
Yeah, HRP.
Yeah, yeah.
But I went with Herr Schwerd.
Yeah, and, specifically to get the just because to get the lieutenants used to handling weapons to frequently shoot to basically internalize the culture of the gun like we do because we're kind of like gun assholes. I mean, that's I'm pretty serious about my guns, and I thought that was a good way to go. I think that with the infantry, particularly, and I was going to say tankers. Oh, that was a Freudian slip. Sorry, or artillery guys or what have you. I would be running those guys every year through the same program I taught at Front Sight, which is a 4-day out of the holster. And, you know, at the end of the thing, you're shooting the target from point blank. I mean, from toe touching the target. That's actually the last round of fire, by the way. That's called a speed rock. You do a speed rock all the way back to the 25 where you're shooting moving stuff. And that's challenging. And I think that would be something that you could do very easily. Even though those little damn ranges that were at Camp Lejeune right along the main side there, those little 25-yard ranges, presentation drills. I did that shit with my Marines in 1-8 all the time, but we didn't have anything else to do because I always had ammo on order for some reason. Go figure. But I like to shoot, and I see what the Marine Corps is trying to do. I think they're being a little bit too cute, and I think that they're not going to – they haven't figured out the unintended consequences of not having that many people pass that thing.
Let's see. Will, do you want to walk us through the course of fire? Just so everybody has an idea if they don't have the article in front of them. And I'll put there's a link to these articles in the post. So all you gotta do is click on it.
Yeah, I'm pulling up the one you sent. So start at the other part of this too is the targets are dramatically different. You know, they've got where you shot placement really matters. So
right.
First one, failure to stop, 2 in the chest, 1 in the brain box at 25.
And again, just so everybody knows, this is not your rifle, iron sight rifle anymore.
Right. You've got an optic on it for sure.
Right.
Yeah.
And the infantry optic just went to 8 power from max of 4 power, now 8 power, so double the magnification. So anyway, continue.
Then another 25-yard drill, 2 targets, 2 in one, 2 in the other, and then headshots. And then third drill is starting at 25 and advance, and you move towards the target, and you do the failure to stop drill while you're moving. Then you go to 25-yard line headshots from standing position, 100-yard line moving targets, 8-second exposure, 100-yard line control pair. That's 2 rounds. 200-yard line moving, same scenarios. 200-yard line control pair, 300-yard line control pair, 500-yard line standing or supported position, 5 rounds in 45 seconds times 8. I got to tell you, I'm wondering how long the training day is for this.
Yeah, that's another practicality part.
Yeah.
Apparently these guys didn't do so good, the volunteers they had who did it. But the idea is they just went out and did it, right, Will?
Yeah. I mean, here's the interesting thing. Let's say you are a F-35 mechanic. You go to boot camp and you do the legacy course, then you go out there to whatever VMFA, whatever they are, and now you go to the range. When did you train to do these things?
Yeah.
Well, the only training you're going to get is on range week. Maybe there's enough iterations, but it seems odd because you're going from an absolute standing start to somewhat of a sprint. Mm-hmm. And you may not have handled a rifle for well over a year before you do it. And again, I'm all about, you know, let's have a better standard. But again, I don't, you know, here's the other thing. Do we really know what the hell we did in Iraq and Afghanistan when it comes to individual marksmanship? Is there a study out there that tells us, no, we're relying on the judgment of the people that are there at a given time. Well, their judgment is scoped to the definite, you know, narrow experience that they had. And I'm sure they had a big conference and everyone argued about it, et cetera. But one of the things that came out of this conference is, well, we need enhanced pistol training. Well, I got to tell you something. I don't know how many people we killed with pistols in the last 20 years. I don't know how many people needed pistols.
You mean enemy or ourselves?
Yeah. Yeah, ourselves. Or, yeah. Yeah. I mean, and I'll tell you straight up why I used to carry a pistol. Because that way I didn't have to carry my rifle into the chow hall. That's the only reason I had a pistol. So these people with this experience are driving things in a certain direction. And again, I applaud certain parts of it, but when I was at Weapons Training Battalion, I saw a certain amount of this insanity without the, what's the problem you're really trying to solve?
Yeah. And the pistol thing, I mean, I had to use my pistol 3 times, years apart. And I thought after the first time I'd never have to do it again. But I did have to do it again. And but I have to tell you, I don't know. You know, I had that training, like Timmy was saying, that HRP thing. And then I thought the stuff we did, the transition drills, the CMP we did before we deployed and everything, and then the sustainment training you do, you know, the back in the saddle stuff you do over there was good. But, yeah, it's true. We just you just don't know. I don't think we were bad, but it takes a lot of rounds to kill a guy.
Well, the other thing, too, with pistols, when we had the Beretta 92 and that green holster with a flap on it,
yeah,
all that is going to do is get you killed in a gunfight.
Yeah.
Right?
Absolutely.
I mean, a real gunfighter has got a weapon that's in condition one with a safety off in a holster that is ergonomic to what they're doing. Well, we never would do that.
Holsters, the thigh holsters we had, we got later on we put them on our chest, you know, because if you're in a turret or something like that. But that's specific shit, you know, based on your day to day habits, I guess. You know?
Yeah, but I would tell you, I commanded a unit that had 700 Marines in it. 700 Marines for 7 months, never once pulled a pistol.
Right.
So the fact that you pulled your pistol.
Yeah, but that was Iraqis and then Afghans. And I mean,
again, though, there's no reason to train the force.
Right.
Oh, yeah. You're right. Right.
Yeah. But this collective wisdom of the people that are implementing a new pistol course.
Right.
They said, oh, no, we need to train the force. And I say, what study did that come out of?
Yeah.
I mean, when we were in Iraq for that 7 months, everyone was required to have a rifle. In fact, we were taking pistols out of the force. I don't know how many people actually employed a pistol. And if it was 1% of the 1st Marine Division, I'd be shocked. I think it would be on the order of 1/1000th of 1%. Well,
like, remember the JAG, Colonel Ewers did.
1/1000th of 1%.
The only picture, you know, the only picture that comes to mind?
First Sergeant.
Yeah.
First Sergeant got shot.
Brad Castle.
And a way to solve that, Castle. In 1st LAR, every single person in that battalion had a rifle with the exception of the chaplain. My battalion surgeons carried rifles.
You know, the thing about a pistol is...
but not you. You had your pistol on.
It's just I had a rifle, too.
No, he had a rifle. Hey, Will's nobody's dummy. He just used a pistol when he had to go to chow.
No, a pistol, you got to use it. It's like a knife that you could be a pussy and it'll still work, you know? If you could touch a guy, why stab him when you can shoot him, you know, from that close? But, yeah, I'll tell you what. I thought the transition drill, if you got guys with rifles and pistols, that's good, you know? You transition from your rifle to a pistol. And but, again, for everybody, not for everybody.
No.
Waste, you know,
for who though? Who? So if you wrote the requirement, who would you have do that?
No one. And then the people that needed it would figure it out and they'd implement it in training. But as a service-wide,
no.
Well, hold on a second, guys. Let me go back a little bit, because when we were second lieutenants, combat marksmanship was something that was talked about but never seen. It wasn't until, who was that guy? Who was the lieutenant colonel, the famous 1911 guy? Cooper.
Cooper.
It was Jeff Cooper opening gun sight in Arizona, where the straight trigger finger, the thumb on the safety, the holding the weapons at the ready, all of that stuff that you see today, all of it started with Jeff Cooper. One guy, because we didn't know shit about combat marksmanship. And you can go back and look at all your Vietnam photos, and how many times do you see guys leaping out of a helicopter with their finger on a trigger? All the time, you know? So we didn't even get really savvy to this high-speed marksmanship stuff until just in the 80s. I just wanted to get that marker out there, because really what we're talking about is light years ahead of whatever Marines prior to us ever received in training. I mean, we've gotten good enough that you start talking quiet eye stuff with people. Quiet eye being the experienced guy looking for where the gun's going to come next. It's a cop term mostly, but gunfighters use it. But we've made some serious strides that way for individuals who need to know that type of information. But getting the rest of the Marine Corps up to that level, I think now we've gotten to a point where the marksmanship that you can train for combatants, the ability to train these guys is so high speed and so advanced that it's not worth trying to keep the rest of the Marine Corps up to speed with that. I think we've definitely hit that spot, which will make old Marines cry, because that every Marine and rifleman was shit that we like to tell everybody.
Yeah, but it was a myth.
I know. It was a myth. It sure was a myth. But it hasn't been that many years.
What's the difference between a myth and a lie?
A myth is well intentioned.
Well, a myth is based on fact.
And then there you go.
Gets exaggerated, and then it gets clouded.
Yeah, I mean the myth of Marine Corps as marksmen is from where?
Bellawood.
Yeah. Bellawood. Shooting Germans at 500 yards across that weekend.
So the myth becomes a self-fulfilling. Every Marine wants to shoot well, you know. But that was
the 5th and 6th Marine Regiment. It wasn't like the Marine Wing Support Squadron 493.
And not only that,
they didn't have one of those.
I would challenge you to figure out how many thousand rounds those Marines shot to kill those Germans.
Well, you know, bazillion, right?
Good point. Because remember Robert Leckie's book, Helmet for My Pillow? He didn't even qualify with the fucking 03 Springfield. He shot UNC like most of those guys.
It's
a machine gun. Man.
I always wanted to ask Robert Leckie, if you're using your helmet for your pillow, where was your gas mask?
Yeah, no shit. That's a good question.
Gas mask. He's the guy who cut his pants open so he could shit without
dysentery. Hey, man, I did that in the Philippines when we were out there in a damn bush there.
That day before yesterday.
in the parking lot of the exchange.
Jeff, I thought you just would wallow in your own filth.
Well, you know.
You've changed.
First it's pleasant, but it gets old.
Speaking of gas masks, pretty sobering little gas mask story. I don't mean to change the tenor of the discussion, but when you're at the National Museum of the Marine Corps and there's a section of combat art, there's a small painting of a Marine, right? He's a World War I Marine. His name's Fred Stockard, gunnery sergeant type. And they're in Bellawood. And one of his Marines is shot. He's on a stretcher, and Stockard, I think that's his last name, is tending to him, and the Germans fire gas. Takes his gas mask off, and he gives it to his Marine, and he dies. Yeah, I mean, you're reading that, and here's and it tells the story of this guy. You know, he's a Marine, gunnery sergeant. And you're like, holy shit. And So I have a picture of that, and I need to put it up in my, in this studio because it belongs in here. But one of the most selfless acts, you know, certain death, right? You take that thing off.
In a painful, miserable death.
Right. Yeah. Drowning.
Easy way to go.
Drowning.
It's either chlorine gas or mustard gas. Either way, it's a horrible way to go.
Right.
Yeah.
The marksmanship. There is nothing that gets greater arguments going in the Marine Corps than this subject right here.
Or whether Paris Island is tougher than San Diego. That's
That's not even a debate.
That's there's at least some humor associated with that one, though.
Yes, yeah.
There's no humor relative to marksmanship. People get fired up and they get pissed. What about you know, infantrymen now and reconnaissance Marines getting different scopes than everybody else? That's
Yeah, this is interesting too.
I like it.
You know, why did we buy the RCO?
Why did we buy the RCO?
Is that rhetorical?
Because it looks awesome.
No. we bought the RCO for target identification.
Right?
Target identification. The enemy was not in uniform. We need to be able to identify the target. We need the optic. Mm-hmm. Improved accuracy is a byproduct of that. Yeah. And it also requires a different kind of training to it. You know, is the RCO the best scope? I have no idea. I'm not really an optic guy.
Yeah.
I would say when I look at the new optic, 2.5 pounds.
What?
On the top of the rifle. 31 really? Ounces. As you were. 2 pounds on top of that. Just under 2 pounds on that. That's a big optic.
Yeah, right? It is. That's unless the thing tells you it's okay to pull the trigger now. You know, yeah.
And there's you know, and so let's break down into some other mythologies. Why do snipers need specialized training? One of the reasons snipers needed specialized training and selection is because they're looking through an optic and they're going to see that guy's head explode. Right now, everyone's looking through an optic. So why do snipers need to have special selection?
Well, originally the reason was because the sniping thing happened, you know, in Vietnam, and they needed to be able to stalk. And but you're right, because now it's more the designated marksman, you know, a situation. You know, there's damn little jungle fighting and a shitload of fucking, urbanized terrain fighting. Yeah. So it's a different thing. You need guys like, exactly. And it's
a new adjustable scope.
And that's why they level get rid of snipers.
It adds a level of complexity to the average rifleman's, you know, chore list. And I, you know, as a battalion commander, before we really added on, we were getting some of the stuff, but it wasn't widely fielded. But I think for people to be proficient in all the accoutrements associated with a rifle now takes a hell of a lot more training than I think a lot of people give credence to. Yeah. I've got a scoped rifle that I bought, and I fired it maybe 8 months ago, and then I fired it seemingly like 2 months ago. And it was like I was handling a new thing. Adjustable, you know, rate and all that. So guys have got, the more complications you add, NVG, adjustable optic, laser, requires more and more and more training, which isn't a bad thing. It's just training is zero sum. You got to tell me what you're going to give up. You can't give up sleep. Brains are not going to give up liberty. You're not going to give up sexual harassment training. What are you going to give up?
I got a week back from the rifle range, just for the record.
Yeah, I don't think you got that week back, because you're going to have to train people before they go to the range. Otherwise, your whole company is going to go unk.
Yeah, imagine that.
So
that's not a bullet I'm looking for on my fitness report.
No. I mean the optic and thank God we're adding.
You mean the this technology, the optic of that on my the optic of that on my years. Career.
You know, we've never used it. Now we're using it, but you don't just pile another thing on top. Yeah. What are you taking away to make sure that we are maximizing the capabilities of these systems?
Will, tell the story about, was it the Commandant that you, it was a marksmanship discussion.
Yeah.
This is classic Constant Weenie story right here. Dialing it up the awkward on the Commandant.
We did a study on rifle combat optic and whether we should use it at entry-level training or not.
Right.
And
I remember.
So the fundamentals of marksmanship are the same. Sight alignment, trigger control. And an optic is just a different type of technology than iron sights. But it's still fundamentally, you got to align your sights. So we did a study, and it proved that for people to be proficient, they needed to be trained. The best way to train people is at entry level. And we had a Marine Corps order that says the purpose of the Marine Corps marksmanship program is to train Marines with a weapon they'll employ in combat. Well, the weapon you employ in combat at that time, by requirement to deploy to CENTCOM, was a rifle with an optic on it. So we did a study. We went to the Marine Corps matches down at Camp Lejeune. At the end of the matches, Commandant gave out the awards, and then we sat down. Commandant was there, division commander, FZG commander, Sergeant Major of the Marine Corps, Sergeant Major this, General that, Colonel this, yada, yada, yada. We give him the brief. We show him all the data. The data says this is a no-brainer. You do it at entry-level training, and you do it throughout the rest of the force. And the Commandant went around the table, and he obviously didn't want to do it, and he polled people. And people said, no, we should just focus on the fundamentals. And I said, well, what are the fundamentals? Sight alignment, trigger control. This sight is just different technology. Iron sights are not the fundamental. The fundamental is sight alignment. Someone says, well, what happens if you get a rifle that the optic doesn't is broken? I say, well, the maintenance readiness rate so far from in theater is on the order of 97%. So do you want to train people for the 3% on iron sights or the 97%? Well, what happens if they got to pick up a foreign weapon because they don't have a rifle and it doesn't have an optic? And I said, well, those are the guys we give Navy crosses to when they pick up foreign rifles and then clear trenches, et cetera.
He's an enlisted guy who gave a Navy comm.
Yeah. So then we poll everyone in the room, and they're all like, no, we should stay the same, stay the same, stay the same. And I'm the last guy polled, and I shit in the punch bowl and said, no, we need to do this. And the Commandant didn't do it. And then two years later, I think we ended up doing it. Because in the end, facts matter.
I heard about that. And to me, the most infuriating thing was the fucking 2 years. I'm like, you know, we'll do whatever you guys tell us. I was the XOSOI at the time. Like, we'll do whatever you guys tell us. I mean, instinctively, my thing was, yeah, we should just do it iron sights. Are we going to, you know, but then if someone said, hey, we're going to do it this way because everybody has these things now, I'm like, yeah, we really don't have the time at SOI because we had a pretty full POI to go from teaching a guy how to do, you know, to teach a guy to shoot with a scope when he learned on iron sights. So, like, yeah, you might as well do it in boot camp. But decide. If those motherfuckers took 2 years.
Well,
if you would have known that Will would have advocated for that, would it have affected your Nightingale personality at the time?
If I what?
If you would have known that Will was advocating for that, would that have influenced your
Nightingale? I figured he was.
what infuriated me is that we had data and they had mythology.
Yeah.
And well, we couldn't overcome the mythology.
We have like, just in defense of our mythology, we have strong mythology. We don't have we do not have weak ass mythology.
Well, and the Commandant at the time said, hey, don't bother me about shooting at boot camp or the parade sequence at 8th and I. I've got those.
That's mine? That's my portfolio. That's my portfolio. Oh,
my. Wow. Don't bother him about those things.
there you go. And you just couldn't let it go, could you, Will?
Well, and I mean, the man signed the Marine Corps order, for God's sakes. Yeah. I thought he was serious when he put his signature on it.
Oh. You got to learn that one pretty early.
I learned it when I was a colonel.
We all learned too late about that one. But he says this. He said he would do that. He said that. Look, he's like, yeah, well, he was lying.
No, it was a myth.
That is what we in the Naval Service call a lie.
Well, you know, it was interesting. You know, Tim alluded to the interview with Kyle Gentry and him talking about, you know, the trepidation of messing with Marine Corps history. But inspired by General Vandegrift saying, we have a duty to get it right to everybody. And he said, I said, yeah, you can cover your ass a few times with General Vandegrift when you're quoting him. And he said, yeah, I always felt pretty solid when I was quoting General Vandegrift. But, you know, I mean, even in that story, you know, as I said in the interview, it's not like you're messing around on the periphery of Marine Corps history. That's the picture. That's the statue, man. That's
The mistake that was made was identifying any of those guys in 1945.
Ever.
Because the picture is perfect. Right. You can't see anyone's face. Yeah. It's all of us. It's everyone who was there on that island, was in that flag raising. And then some jackass wanted to sell war bonds, so they had to identify the people.
Yeah.
And there you go.
Yep.
Probably a lawyer, right?
Or a PAO. Watching that flag of our fathers was painful, watching what they did to those guys.
Oh.
And it's even more painful when you know that Doc Bradley, what the hell he's carrying inside of him throughout that ordeal.
Well, I mean, he probably forgot. I think I raised it. I don't remember.
His uniform is so distinct.
I think he knew.
Oh, my God.
He knew his whole life.
Yeah, he knew. He knew but couldn't say anything for whatever reason.
But, you know, and that's what makes me laugh. He's probably sitting there, as I said to Kyle, these guys are idiots. That's not even close to the uniform I was wearing. At some point, somebody's going to see one of these pictures, right? My pants are cuffed. It's the way I wore them. I never wore my leggings, right? I never had a pair of wire cutters on my ass ever. And nobody's figured that shit out. He's just sitting there going,
Well, you think about it. They were told, hey, you were in it, weren't you? Get your ass in there and get out of here.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely.
No, General, that wasn't me.
Right. No, but I mean, his
Bradley's shot to shit, man. Yeah. He's fucking, you know, he almost died right there in that fucking island, you know. So it's like
Navy Cross. And he raised the first flag bigger than shit. That's him raising the first flag.
Yeah, but you know, I mean, he gets back there, and that PAO Lieutenant Colonel says, "This is you, right, Doc? You've been identified by two different people. This is you," and his name's already been put out there in the public. John Bradley. So what's he going to say? No, it ain't me. You know, we need you on this war bond drive, right? You're the Navy's representative. Let's go do this thing, Doc. All right.
Well,
then he's thinking like, okay, I'll do this thing and it'll all blow over. It'll all go away. Right? Fuck. Yeah. No. No, and you know what? John Bradley lives a distinguished life every day he walked on this planet. You watch
Stolen Valor guy. He's no Stolen Valor guy.
Yeah,
he's
Navy Cross.
Straight up hero.
Yeah.
Yeah, straight up fucking hero.
Great guy in his community.
That platoon had more respect, I think, than any other platoon in Marine Corps history. As far as number of Navy Crosses, number of, like, they had one Medal of Honor at least. That platoon had put that flag up there. Yeah. They had, Lindbergh, Silver Star.
I met him. You know, I met him years later.
Keith Wells, Navy Cross.
Do you remember when Wells came to IOC, Timmy?
Yeah, sure do, man. That guy was awesome. That was cool.
I get a call from the adjutant of the basic school, and I think I just happened to pick up the phone, or somebody handed me the phone saying, hey, they want to talk to somebody over here. Hello? Hey, there's a lieutenant who's a platoon commander on Iwo Jima. would you guys like him to come over? And I'm like, I'll be over there in like 5 minutes. We had maps laminated of Iwo Jima, right? And I run over there, and Keith Wells, a big man. He's from Texas, had a big mustache. Mm-hmm. And we sat in the library at the time of IOC around one of those tables with maps out there. And, I mean, he's just awesome. Awesome. Yeah. Awesome
Friggin
guy.
Cool.
Right.
Yeah. Well, his platoon sergeant got the Navy Cross, too. Staff Sergeant Thomas. He got killed in Iwo Jima, though.
Right. Yeah, Keith Wells. But, no, if you didn't get a chance to listen to it, you know, Kyle Gentry, I didn't know Kyle was a Naval Academy guy, but he.
Oh yeah, he's my class.
Really?
Yeah.
There you go. Now that explains it. The no wonder he's so brilliant. But he talks.
I think he was. Maybe he was junior to me.
Was he in Killer's class or your class?
I can't remember. Maybe I just ripped his ass. That's why I thought.
But no, he talks about being able to be on all three boards. And just what an incredible experience it was, to be able to walk through Marine Corps history. The cool, in my opinion, the coolest part of the interview is he tells a story about finding out that Dick Wheeler, who was part of this company, right, and he was a prolific Iwo Jima writer. He says that in a footnote there it says Harold Pye Keller, audio recording. And then this master sergeant, who Kyle mentions this to, tracks down Wheeler's sister. He's dead already. His stuff is still the same in his bedroom, and all of his papers are down in the basement. And so Kyle gets in his car or flies up there, after he talks to the sister. He goes down in the basement and hears the tape of Harold Keller. He gets that converted to an MP3. Right, and it has to, they have to treat the tape because it'll disintegrate if you just try to play it, and he takes a copy of it to Iowa to give to Pye Keller's daughter, right, and he's been dead since 1975, and she tells a story that he was going to record this, and I wanted to hear what he had to say, but he knew that I was sitting on the stairs. And then he'd say, I'm not going to say anything till you go upstairs. And she said, I tried to shut the door, but be right still there. And he said, I'm not going to talk. And he said, she hits play and there's a pause before he speaks. And so it was like, is there something wrong? And all of a sudden you hear his voice. And he said, I'm standing behind her and you can see her body move as her father starts to speak. And in kind of the funny moment, she says, I'm so happy his great-grandson is going to be able to hear his voice and get to know his great-grandfather. And Kyle says, you might want to listen to that because not all of that's age-appropriate. Your dad is pretty direct in some of his comments.
Yeah, your dad was stacking them up.
That Richard Wheeler guy, that his book is the best book about Evo, I think.
He's one of them. He's one of them.
He talks about everybody. He talks about the company commander, Dave Severance. He talks about the one guy made it all the way from that company, all the way to the end. And he had shrapnel in his stomach and he was bent over getting back on the ship, And there was one guy who made it because they turned the roster over twice. Right. The only two guys who made it the whole way was the captain, Dave Severance, and this kid who I can't remember. And Wheeler wasn't one of them.
Wheeler gets it on the second or the third day.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he wasn't there long. Yeah.
Is Dave Severance still alive? I mean, he...
I don't think so, man.
Couldn't be.
He became a fighter pilot in Korea.
Dave Severance is still alive.
No shit. He'd
have to be 100 years old.
He's 102.
102, yeah.
Holy fuck, wow. He retires a colonel.
It just says Wikipedia, born in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, age 102, born on February 4th, 1919. Battles, World War II, Bougainville, yikes, and the Battle of Iwo Jima, Korean War, Vietnam War, award, Silver Star, Distinguished Flying Cross, and four air medals.
Yeah. Whoa.
Imagine that.
He didn't get a Purple Heart on Iwo Jima. He didn't get hit at all.
He was a paramarine.
Yeah. So was Ira Hayes.
Yeah, that's why, kind of when Rennie Gagnon says, I can't give you that guy's name, right? Ira Hayes fights in where did he fight before Iwo Jima? Do you know, Jeff?
I think he was on, if not Guadalcanal, he might have been on Bougainville too.
Nah, I think it wasn't Guadalcanal.
They didn't jump, but they fought a lot. Yeah.
But those guys
General Krulak's dad. General Krulak the Elder, he got the Navy Cross for doing a demonstration on one of the northern Solomon Islands, and they got picked up by PT boats, and the PT boat he was on was JFK's. And one of his guys died in JFK's bunk.
No shit.
And JFK had two bottles of, you know, that black and white scotch with the dogs on it?
Yeah. You
know, Scotty dogs. He passed it around to Krulak and all his guys that were on his PT boat. And then being a gifted brown noser that he was, his son only eclipsed by his son, when Kennedy got inaugurated, he sent him two bottles of black and white scotch. And he brought Krulak in, who, you know, was just a colonel then, I think.
What the hell?
Said, hey. And they reminisced about that, you know, that extraction.
Hey, Krulak the Elder saved my mom. Saved my mom from a Chinese troop chain in China back when he was a captain.
What?
Yeah, my grandfather was a regimental surgeon. He put him on the wrong train, him and my grandmother. Oh. And Krulak led this patrol that went running out after the train to get him. And they stopped the train. They come on board. My grandmother said, the biggest Marine Corps captain I ever saw in my life came on board and got your mother and me and off the train. And then she met him after World War II. And she goes, oh, my God, he's shorter than I am. I don't know what the hell I was thinking.
Yeah,
one of those weird stories.
Yeah, think of Severance. He's been collecting that pension for 53 years.
Make him pay.
Congratulations to us all.
Make him pay. Ira Hayes, Vella Lavella.
As long as you can.
Ira Hayes, Vella Lavella, Bougainville, the consolidation of the Northern Solomons. What the hell is that?
Yeah, it's New Georgia and shit.
Yeah.
And then the Battle of Iwo Jima. Yeah, no. Rene Gagnon, you know, when you have somebody that's a Native American that has gone through that and was a paramarine and looks at you and says, if you give them my name, I'll kill you. Would you take that to the bank or not?
Oh yeah.
Gang is a rat for ever saying his name. Shame on him.
I would take that shit to the bank, man. And then Kyle tells a story that Ira Hayes said, I'm not going. And they take him to Keith Wells' hospital room in Hawaii, and Wells says, no, you have to. And then he says, okay, I'll go. And then he comes back in a relatively short manner. But, I mean, the human drama of all that stuff is, in my opinion, fascinating. You know, and Ira Hayes, you know, once he's away from his, you know, his tribe, if you will, his Marine, you know, buddies, I mean, he's, you know, he's isolated and his life falls apart and he ultimately drinks himself to death. But no, if you haven't heard it, listen to it. Kyle's, you know, his experience with all of that. Is fascinating to listen to him tell these nuanced stories of all these guys. And, you know, Gagnon's son, right? He shits on James Bradley because Bradley's not very kind to his father in the book, right? And so when Bradley's kicked off the statue, you know, Rene Gagnon Jr. is like, yeah, got what he deserved, right? And then he gets booed. Right? Then he gets his father gets booted off the statue, and I remember seeing an interview with him, and he was like in shock. Like, my father, my whole life, I mean, this is my father. And he said he was in it, and he's the only one that's not. So
a little different than Bradley's story, huh?
A little bit different. A little bit different, but no. All right, what are you reading, Jeffrey?
Well, believe it or not, on my Kindle I bought The Art of the Deal by former President Trump.
No kidding.
Yeah, I'm going to start reading it tonight. I'm going to read it while I'm at my mom's house, and I'm going to, you know, talk to her about it.
You are house hunting, just for the record. So you're.
Yes, Lori is doing the house hunting, actually.
Oh, you're going to come in and make the deal? Is that how this is going to work after you read the book?
Fuck no, man. I'm going to do whatever I'm told when it comes to it. I'm going to fork over money. And I trust him totally. Well, it's Lori, but it's also my stepson, who's very savvy with stuff.
Got it.
So
your deal-making skills will not enter into this deal?
No, even though I am a gifted recruiter, that's...
Hey, you liar.
Yeah.
Myth peddler?
That's the key. There's no better lie than when you tell every... Like General Krulak is the most gifted liar I ever met, because he could say six true things, but as a whole, it was a lie. You know, and that's an art. You know,
there you go.
That's
there
an art.
As George Costanza would say, remember, Jerry, it's not a lie if you believe it.
Yeah, right.
Timmy, what are you reading?
I went back to one of our favorite authors, H.W. Brands, and I've got his book on Ulysses S. Grant. And it's called The Man Who Saved the Union. And I'm about, I don't know, four or five chapters in. And to date, Grant seems to have spent most of his early Army life writing the most forlorn letters to his wife, who wasn't very responsive to his letters. It's weird. But it's a strange story about a guy, and I'm still trying to figure out, because he ends up being one of the greatest of us Americans ever were.
He doesn't look like that. He doesn't look like that guy in his pictures.
What's that?
He doesn't look like that guy. He looks like a hard drinking general in the pictures I've seen of Grant.
Oh yeah. This is I'm talking about in his younger days.
I know, but he doesn't look like a sappy mush boy that's writing
little
letters.
Sappy guy, yeah. But he didn't like. I don't know. He's an enigma to me. It's an very enigma. Interesting how I think he's a fascinating guy. So I'm enjoying reading and learning more about him.
Where does enigma fall in the myth liar spectrum? Where does enigma?
Enigma. An enigma.
No, enigma's a mystery. It doesn't fall in there at all.
Yeah, I'm going to go with Jeff, as a matter of fact. Thank you, Jeff.
You're welcome.
Hey, by the way, dude, so you're going to go up there in like Summerlin or someplace like that, right? Yeah. right around from front sight, man. We can go take shooting,
and
go take
will.
Classes. Yeah. I'll get you in for free. $2,000 for you, nothing. There you go.
Wow.
Yeah.
And our resident enigma, Will, what are you reading?
I am reading Crazy Horse and Custer by Stephen Ambrose.
Oh.
Wow, Stephen Ambrose.
Yeah, it's an old book. I think he published it in the 70s. But it's a biography, a parallel biography of both until they meet in the end. So it's pretty interesting.
Huh. You know, Custer... I did a lot of cavalry reading, starting at the basic school, and Custer had a bad day that day. That's not his best decision-making day that day. You know, he has a lot of not small bits of information that says this is a bad idea, and his kudwi was not so much that day, man. And yeah.
He had a cataract that day.
He did have a cataract. Mm-hmm. His kudwi was not kudwi that day. I mean, and he gets told by a bunch of people. I'm reading Investigating Iwo. I would tell you, I read Kyle's essay. And again, you can get it for free. You know, if you want to get it for free, send me an email and I'll send you the link that you can request it at. But let me just tell you, this stuff is fantastically written. There's just a ton of pictures in it. And, you know, Kyle writes a chapter in it, and it's called In Fairness to All, where he talks about the challenges of doing this with the technology available to the Devalier board and whatnot. Yeah. And very, very just absolutely, absolutely well written. So I would recommend it to you. And the pictures are just cool. One of my favorite pictures, in fact, I will show it to you, men, right now. Now, everybody else cannot see this because this is not televised. But if you can imagine, you know, at the top of the summit, Harold Schreier, lieutenant type, who rose to the rank of lieutenant colonel, and I think when we track him to the chosen reservoir, he never makes colonel. Right. Harold Schreier.
Everything he can get except the Medal of Honor, though.
Right, but somebody wrote us and said that was because of service limits, not because that he couldn't go any further or something like that. But anyway, Schreier orchestrates the first flag coming down, the second flag going up simultaneously, because he doesn't want anybody to think that, you know, the Japanese have retaken the summit and that's why the flag's down. So one came down, the other one went up. And then there's a picture of Schreier and Boots Thomas from behind. And now they're on top of Mount Suribachi. Okay? There's a fucking battle going on. And you know what those two guys do? They salute.
Yeah.
I love this picture. Because this is like Chucklehead Marine Corps stuff. They did what? Well, they both saluted them, and they both got shot and killed.
Like, but all the ships offshore were all ringing their bells, and fucking guys were cheering and shit like that. It must have been something.
Yeah, you know? The it's great. Kyle says there was more ships off of Iwo Jima than there are in the entire United States Navy right now.
Oh yeah, easily.
Well, last time we were talking, Tim was saying they could hit Mount Suribachi with 16 inches from 360 degrees as much as they wanted. Man, I don't know how they just didn't – just wouldn't exist anymore. It'd be like a flat surface, you know.
Yeah. No, that's crazy. All right, boys.
It chewed up. You could see on Suribachi today, you could see where those naval gunfire rounds were hitting. Yeah. It chewed up the face of that mountain fierce. It was most impressive 50 years later when I saw it.
Yeah. Yep. No, that's that's no joke. Those 16-inch rounds from point blank. I mean, that would – yeah, go ahead and peek out the window, see what it looks like. Right. Hey, Timmy, you want to peek out the window for us, see what you see out there?
Is that the mail buoy?
The old man said he had the New Jersey shoot for him once on the DMZ, and he said when the 16-inchers came in, everybody stopped fighting. Everybody stopped shooting. He said that the North Vietnamese, you know, Chuhoid away or whatever they had, DD Mount away, and the Marines kept on like inching back. He said it was very, very, very frightening to have those 16 inches anywhere near you.
Yeah, I saw it fire in front when Webb came out, and I was in the IO on the Ranger. I was first lieutenant, the XO, the Mardet, and they slewed all nine guns off the starboard side, and we pulled up behind them, and they let all nine guns rip at once. They shot a 5-inch gun, and somebody said, "Is that it?" And then all of a sudden, right, just this wall of flame. And I remember thinking, Jesus, if that's what it looks like coming out, like, what does it look like when it hits?
A bad day, man.
Yeah. Anyway. Yeah.
Just ask the Hezbollah in fucking 1983 and 84.
Hey, man, the New Jersey, at that one, whatever the 10-fathom line or whatever it is she crawls up on, that damn thing was sitting right off of the Corniche Highway. I mean, it looked like you could throw a rock and hit it when it was broadsiding into the into those mountains. That was a cool fucking day.
Well, and let me tell you.
That I witnessed from a ship, you know, miles away with the big eyes, because that's what I was doing then.
They look.
Listen to your Donna Summer records in the.
I had a Walkman. You had a Walkman in 83. There weren't Walkmans then, were there? No. Yeah, there was. Maybe there was.
Yeah, they had. I see transistor radios.
I don't know about these
with little things you stick in your ear, so you could.
I don't know. Anyway,
but the battleships. Yeah. I mean, they sat low in the water too.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. They look when I think it was the Iowa that was out there in the North Arabian Sea at the time, but it looked like I loved watching that thing, right? Because it made you feel like you were in Victory at Sea or some shit like that. You'd see this thing, like, you know, coming right near the Ranger. Oh man, it was like
I just heard this song in my head when you said it. Victory at Sea. Dun, 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 dun. Yeah. I can remember that stuff instantly.
And then the sailors though said it was the best duty because all the ammunition stuff, right, had all been automated. Right. And the anti-aircraft guns were no longer manned. So there was just a shit ton of room to live in on the ship.
Yeah. Imagine World War II. There's probably 2,000 gunner's mates on that ship.
No kidding.
Yeah. All the 40 Mike Mike and 20 Mike Mike aircraft.
Probably had 2,000 gunner's mates.
Yep.
Yeah. Yep. All just now video gaming suites that they could go down. I don't even think we had them at the time, but anyway. All right, boys. thank you very much. Thoroughly enjoyed it. And let me just, you know, hats off to Jeff and Will. Both got headsets, and the audio sounds fantastic. So we finally get to hear the wonderful baritone of Jeff Kenny's voice.
Yes.
With that weird halo effect of the light behind you, bro, you look semi-divine.
Let's just hope the Mac remembered to hit record on this one.
Yes.
You know, does it matter? We had a good time talking anyway, fellas.
My wife and my stepson, the same one who's helping us out, they op-checked this thing while I was slaving away at the meth this afternoon. So it's hers. She's responsible for any kind of good reception.
Well,
so I'm going to put on, like Tim was listening to his Donna Summer records. I'm going to put on my ALBA Greatest Hits records as soon as we party down here, guys.
And do you know how many wars were fought by people listening to ABBA? You know, you figure what? South Africa?
It's
Vietnam?
ABBA. It's ABBA, for God's sake. ABBA.
I mean, just think about that. Those are like war fighting songs from back when. Yeah. So, the Norwegian guys told me that. They said, yeah, all we listened to was ABBA.
I thought it was Kylie Minogue. Something like that. Uh-huh. You want to hear? Here's a great barbershop story of Camp Fallujah. The barbers were from Pakistan. I can't remember where they were from. India?
No, probably India.
Yeah,
so,
it would be India. It was
so
Pakistan.
I go into this. It was a barbershop I hadn't been in before, but they said there's not a big line there. So I go there, and of course there's a big line, right? But I'm already there, so I'm like, fuck it. So I get in. They cut my hair, and the guy looks at me at the end. He goes, "Do you want the flame?" Right? And what do you say, right? I'm not a fucking pussy, man. Of course I want the flame. Can I have two of them? I have no idea what the fucking flame is, right? But he says this, and there's all these Marines sitting there. You want the flame? I'm like, of course. So he has this paper clip straightened out with a ball of cotton on the end in an alcohol bottle. He pulls it out. He lights it on fire. And he burns all the hair, the small hairs off your ears and wherever the hell they're hanging. And he goes, "There you go." And I said, "Thank you very much." But, you know, to me, it's like quintessentially stupid Marine shit, right? Right? Is that I have no idea what the fucking flame is, right? But, I mean, hey, we're Marines, man.
Hey, you know what? If you heated up a dog tag chain with that and ran it through your nose, out your ear, because I saw Marines do that for years, man. You know, you got the flame in the chain? Yes.
But that shit still makes me laugh, right? Because it's quintessentially, I don't know if it's intrinsic to being a grunt or what, like of course I want the flame. Like, yeah. I have no fucking idea what it is. And then, like, he starts messing with, you know, the, and I'm like, well, what the fuck's he gonna do with it? You know, I don't know. I guess I'll find out. But right, if the rest of these jackasses can do it, I know I can. So anyway, the flame. Yeah, but the reason I remember that story, Kylie Minogue is on a loop with her Australian blonde hair, you know, in some array of hot pants. And this thing went on and on and on and on. Oh, she's blonde. She's so beautiful. That's right.
Oh, yeah, in the barbershop, for
yeah.
sure.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, because that's the way they do it. Blonde and beautiful in the land of the dark hair is a...
They hope to immigrate someday to Sweden and chase around a park and everything and get arrested.
Well. All right, boys. Thank you very much. Have a great night.
All right.
That'll do it. I'm still laughing about all of that. Jeff talking about using whiteout on his front side post. Oh, man. This stuff's too funny. Stuff's too funny. I don't know that we solved anybody's problem tonight. But I think you can hear some of Will. Obviously, you could tell his background and also his billets that he's been in dealing with this kind of stuff. So, for what it's worth. Anyway, have a great day. Don't be afraid to change somebody's life. Yep. That's serious business. So don't be afraid to do that. And tomorrow, the chef is going to be here. Greg Lotus is going to be here. So that'll be fun on a Friday. And so have a great day. I hope in some way, shape, or form, this made your life better. And made you smile a little bit. So, have a great one. On a Thursday, All Marine Radio. Oh.